So in the last few classes, we have seen the massless spectrum. So we constructed perturbative string theories. So that is how the things are called, perturbative string theories. Mainly what we did is to construct a massless spectrum. So we discussed the bosonic string, type 1 string, let's say open strings in RNS formalism. We saw type 2 string theories, so type 2 A and type 2 B, which were mainly closed string theories. Strings, RNS formalism, and then we have seen heterotic strings. Now, for heterotic strings, it was so we discussed the massless spectrum and other theories. Heterotic strings had one interesting property that we discussed, so we discussed it in detail for heterotic strings, namely an SO32 non-abelian symmetry. So there are actually SO32 non-abelian gauge fields in the spectrum, massless ones, and we also saw that there is the possibility, even though I didn't explain this in detail, of having an E8 times E8 symmetry as well. I didn't discuss it, but from what we have already learned in these lectures, you should be able maybe to take one of the books, your favorite one, and read about the construction of the E8 times E8 heterotic string. Now, so this we focus on the massless spectrum because once we are going, if we are interested in the low energy effective action in the low energy modes, right? So it's the massless spectrum, the one that is that we are going to see. So if, for example, in the massless spectrum we found a graviton in one of the theories, let's say in this one in type 2A theories, then we know that if we write down a low energy effective action in 10 dimensions for this mode, well, the low energy effective action is going to be an Einstein term, so we can write an action for this. Maybe if we have Young-Mills fields, like over here, SO32 gauge fields, there's going to be stuff like this, and so on. So once we write down low energy effective actions, the massless fields that we constructed over here are the ones that are going to appear in the action. And if we would like to construct, for example, standard-like models, so it's stuff like this that we need, right? So we need non-abelian gauge fields, and this is why we are these are so important. So it's SO32 gauge field or E8 times E8 gauge fields. Now, so what are we going to do today? Today we are going to. I would like to discuss. String theories compactified on a circle, and we are going to discuss several things, namely so today we are going to have we are going to focus on bosonic strings because this illustrates the idea strings compactified on S1. So and we are going to learn several things. First about something that is called T-duality. So and this is going to be the first example that we are going to discuss of something that is usually called string geometry, namely that the geometry as seen by a point particle and the geometry as seen by a string are going to be different. String geometry. Then we are going, so this we are going to see for closed strings, closed bosonic strings. Then we are going to use T-duality as a tool to predict new objects that are going to be D-brains. And we are going to see that on this void volume of the D-brains, there's a new way of constructing non-abelian gauge fields. So besides having non-abelian gauge fields over here for heterotic strings, on the void volume of D-brains, if they are coincident, we are going to see that we can have non-abelian gauge symmetry. Okay. Right, so let's start talking about key duality. And close bosonic strings. So until now, when we have discussed closed bosonic strings, we always took the background to be flat Minkowski space. Right, so now what we are going to illustrate it, let me think. The picture maybe in three dimensions. So let's say this xy plane over here. So we took this would represent the flat Minkowski space. Now what we're going to do is to compactify one of the dimensions in a circle. And then instead of having this flat plane, what we are going to have is something like this. And let's say we are going to call the dimension that is compact x25. Right, so there are, for the bosonic string, we know there are fields x mu, mu is equal to 0 to 25. So one of the dimensions we are going to assume to be compactified on a circle, maybe like this. So x25 is identified with x25 plus 2 pi r. So r is going to be the radius over here of the circle. Now, until now, each time we talked about closed strings, the type of boundary conditions that we did impose, so closed strings, and maybe I write it over here, so closed strings, let's say in Minkowski space, would have boundary conditions like this, tau, sigma, plus 2 pi. So this would be identified with x25 of tau sigma. Now, if we periodically identify the 25th dimension like this, with 2 pi r here, then there's another possibility. Namely, what we can do is, so in this case, so if, let's say, x25 is a circle, n is 1, then what we can also consider are boundary conditions like this. Sigma plus 2 pi is equal to x25 when tau sigma. And again, since it's identified up to 2 pi r, I can have a factor 2 pi r times w, where w is an integer. So because the 25th dimension is identified anyway up to 2 pi r, so when I go like this along the coordinate of the string, I can have a factor 2 pi r times w. So any idea what this number w can mean? So w is an integer, so w is going to be something like something in z. So exactly. So w is going to be a winding number, right? So because it says that if we go once along the string, so this is what the sigma says, so we go from 0 to 2 pi, then we are going to go, let's say w is 5 times along the 25th dimension. So what this means is, so let's say w is, for example, equal to 2. Then the idea is going to be, so we go once around the string, and we go something like this. So hopefully my picture is going to be good enough. So we go once around the string, but this makes us go twice along the compactified dimension, right? And then we come back to the original point. So in this case, the winding number would be 2. So so W is the winding number of the string around the compact dimension. Okay. Now, in order to allow for this type of boundary conditions for the coordinate x25, we have to change the mode expansion a little bit. So in order to get a factor like this, what we have to do is to change the zero mode. So the oscillators are going to stay the same, but the zero mode, so we have to change. So for, so just let me put a star on this. So to obtain star as boundary condition. And we are assuming that only one of the coordinates is compact, so x25, while the remaining one, once x0 to x24, they are still going to be non-compact. So they are still going to satisfy boundary conditions like this, where 25 is replaced by the other directions. Now, for the x25 coordinate, so we have to change the mod expansion like this. Let me actually, now, as you know, I'm not being very careful here with factors of two or anything. So actually, I want sigma to lie between 0 and pi. So I'm not going to be very careful here with the factors of 2 anyway, but I think you already know this. So then we have to allow for x25 a term 2rw times sigma. And then there are going to be the oscillators that I'm going to denote by dots that are not going to be changed. Okay, so this is saying that if sigma goes to sigma plus pi, so x25 is going to go to x25 plus 2 pi r times w. So it's doing exactly what it is supposed to do. Now, so we have one integer there that is called the winding number. Now it turns out that there is another integer that is called the momentum number. Namely, now we have to take into account that if one of the coordinates is periodic like this, then the momentum in the periodic direction is going to be quantized. So since, write it over here. So since x25 is periodic, p25 is quantized. Now to see this, note that if I have quantum mechanical particle, and let's say it's free moving in space, the wave function is going to have a factor like this, i25, x25. Right, so I want this to be single valued once we go around the compact dimension. So if x25 goes over to x25 plus 2 pi r, this is going to get an additional factor p25 2 pi r times the same thing, 25 times x25. And this should be single valued over here, while it's the same. That p25 has to be equal to an integer divided by r. Now, where k is an integer. So one of the coordinates being compact is changing the mode expansion then in the following way. So we need to include a term proportional to sigma like this, right, to be able to have something like a winding number to let the string wind around the compact dimension. Moreover, p25 over here is going to be quantized as k divided by r, where k is an integer. So what I want to do next is see how this process of compactifying on a circle is going to change the mass formula of the states that we obtain. So x mu for mu is equal to 0 to 24 is still going to be same mod expansion as previously discussed once we were in Minkowski space. But for x25, we now have that the momentum is quantized in the 25 direction times tau. We have to allow winding like this. And then there are the oscillators that are going to be the same, so those are not modified. Now we can split this into left movers and right movers. Right, so the computation is easy enough. Alpha 0, 25, plus oscillator, so there are left movers as well. We're talking about the closed string, so 1/2. Oops, I'm sorry. That's not right. That's not what I wanted to write. 1/2 x25 plus 1/2 alpha 0 times and sigma plus dots. Well, we can read off the zero mode of the alphas of this operators over here. Simply, I mean, we just compute them, right? So and here's the result. So alpha zero 25 is equal to k divided by r times w times r. Alpha zero tilde is k divided by r plus w. Questions?
How general are you getting? Because we haven't really, like, you said we're doing it for a closed boson extreme, but all this carries over to an open boson extreme, right?
We are going to discuss the open one in a moment, and the story is actually different, so we are going to come to different conclusions. Right? So this, at this moment, it's particular only to the closed ring, because we are talking about left movers and we're talking about right movers.
Like all this before.
And then we will talk only about one type of mode, so we won't be talking about alpha and alpha tilde. So I mean, we know how to change the story, of course, and that's exactly what we are going to do in a moment, right? But if I keep two of these oscillators, then it has to be the ones that would be it has to be the closed ring, otherwise they would be related. Okay. So we are going to that's exactly what we are going to do, right? To do the same story for the open string. So we are going to see in a moment. Okay, now, so these objects, of course, enter now in the mass formula. So the next thing that I want to do is to compute the mass spectrum for the states that we obtain. Again, we have a ground state, and we are going to act with oscillators on the ground state to construct the spectrum. Now, so let's derive the mass formula. Again, so I'm going to do this in an impressionistic way, but I think at this moment we are done several times, and it should hopefully be good enough. So what we are going to do is, so we are going to derive the mass formula in the same way as, for example, when talking about the closed bosonic string. Now, in this case, we are compactifying one of the dimensions on a circle. So we want to pretend sort of that we don't see this, that we don't see this circle, and we want to write m squared as some. The circle is small, we don't see it, and we want to write the mass formula for something just living instead of 26 dimensions, just living in 25 dimensions. So we are just summing over 25 of these moments. Now, the L0 and L0 bar constraints still hold. Right, so this means that we are still going to impose the constraint. So again, so I'm not being careful with the practice. We are still going to impose the constraint that L0 minus 1 annihilates all the states in the spectrum. And let me split up the thing with the index 25. So here we have the starts of 1. So here we have the oscillators, alpha n minus 1. So let me call this operator here nr. So these are the right numbers. And this should still annihilate the state. So when acting on states, this should be, I'm missing one of the terms. Excuse me. The rest of the momenta sum for mu is equal to 0 to 24 alpha 0 mu squared. So the only thing I did is to pull out one of these factors, the one with mu is equal to 25 from the sum. Then we have the oscillators. And this, when acting on states, should be equal to 0. This over here is the sum over p mu squared. Mu is equal to 0 to 24. And this over here is this operator that we have been calling n. So in this case, let's call it an r for right movers. So if that is equal to 0, I can write the sum over the momenta in terms of alpha 0 times alpha squared and in terms of nr eigenvalues. So on the same I can do for a 0 bar, right? So then I would be writing this for alpha 0 tilde. So this would be the same, and this would be tilde oscillators. So in that case, so here's the mass formula that we get. So alpha prime times m squared is equal to alpha 0, 25 squared. And let me now actually use the correct factors here. So that's equal to alpha 0, 25 squared plus 2nr minus. We have computed those things here, this alpha 0 over there, so we know the result. So now we can take this two equations. So there we can read off the difference, right, of an element in R, and then we can take the sum. So here's the result. The level matching condition in the case that we compactify on a circle is going to be changed. Then it's going to be changed like this, W times momentum. Remember that for in Minkowski space, this was always equal to 0, but now we have a circle coordinate. And then it can be equal to W times K. That's equal to alpha prime this object over here. I'm going to leave them alone. All right, so this is how the mass formula changes if we have one of the coordinates to be a circle. Now this mass formula, so NL and NR, these are integers, right? So take all possible values. Now this formula has a symmetry under interchange of things. Somebody sees how it works?
Should we know the square there, or is that the first round bracket? Should that be squared or not?
Sorry, I should have forgot the dimension.
And in your square bracket, should they both be squared?
Oh, yes. Oh, I actually don't see the symmetry.
Yeah.
That's important. I'm sorry. So this formula has a certain symmetry.
You can change R into one or into constant or R into constant or is related to K alpha and W.
Almost. It goes in the right direction. Now, so we know. Okay. So we know W and K, these are integers, arbitrary integers, right? Now, so we can interchange them if we want. So if we take, so if we interchange W and K, this one doesn't change, right? So if we do, so we want to interchange this to integers, so they can be arbitrary integers, interchange these. But then if we look at this, what do we have to do? To see the symmetry. Right, so then we have to interchange also R with alpha prime divided by R, right? Hopefully the alpha primes are right. Okay, I think so. Yeah. So if we interchange, if we interchange W and K, these two integers, and at the same time we send the radius to alpha prime divided by radius to formulas learning. Now, so this is an important symmetry, an important property of the spectrum, and it's called K-duality. So now this is sort of, it has important, let's say, philosophical consequences, because what this is saying is that the spectrum is invariant under exchanging a large radius and a smaller radius. So if we talk about a circle and we use points to prop the circle, we can of course always say a circle is big or a circle is small, right? We know the difference, right? We look at it. But what this is saying is if we use a string to prop this geometry, a closed string, then we will never be able to tell the difference between a circle being large and a circle being small, right? So because a small circle is actually, if R is very, very small, that is actually equivalent to a large circle. So this is the first example of something that is called string geometry. So a large circle is one, so is in some sense equivalent to small. S1 if propped by a string instead of a prime particle. Right, so that's the first example of what is sometimes called string geometry. So again, according to which, so large and small circles is sort of the same, and the geometry seen by point particles is not always the same as the geometry seen by strings. Question?
So this symmetry is just a symmetry of the mass spectrum.
Exactly. Yeah, so we have seen it in the spectrum. There are different proofs of this. So as long as we have a perturbative string, so that is supposed to be a symmetry of the theory, one can show it also, for example, directly from the action. So we have just checked, I mean, the master spectrum, that's true, but we want to take, of course, interactions so it's interesting. But it can be. Right. Now, so there is a different way of stating the symmetry that is going to be more useful once we generalize this to open strings, and namely, so I'm not being careful about the alpha primes here, I should probably put the alpha prime over here. So there's a different way, instead of saying winding and momentum is exchanged and radius is exchanged, what we can actually do is to look at these, at these modes, and then if we interchange K and W, and so if we perform this K-duality, what happens is that alpha 25 goes over to minus alpha 0.25, while this one here stays the same. Okay. One can actually show maybe you believe this part. There's a small computation actually in the book that that shows that the entire mod expansion is changed. So one can show that it's not only the zero mod, but the entire mod expansion gets a minus sign. So one can show. So the computation is in the book. That under T duality, so the entire mod expansion, not only the zero mod, gets a minus one. And this stays the same. So that's a different way, again, of formulating T duality, but not in a way that we can use for open space. So now let's do the same thing now for open strings. So what would happen then? So T duality and of now, so we are going to have, again, so that is going to be x25, that is going to be hat, x25 plus 2 pi hat. Now imagine that I have an open string and I have Neumann boundary conditions. What's the winding number going to be? So I have Neumann boundary conditions and I have one dimension that is a circle, right? Open string with Neumann boundary conditions. What's the winding number? Okay, let me ask a different question. Does it make sense to talk about a winding number? It doesn't make sense, of course. Because, I mean, if the ends are not fixed, right, so it doesn't really make sense to talk about a winding number. So you cannot, if the string is open, so you have it floating around, you cannot talk about a winding number. So in this case, so for Neumann boundary conditions, there is no winding. Now we still see the quantization of the momentum in the 25 direction, but there's no winding number. Now this means that imagine that we start with a string. So what I want to do is to start with a string with Neumann boundary conditions, and then apply T duality and see what we get. So since there is no winding, well, the mod expansion is simply going to be the same, except that we still need to quantize the momentum in the 25 directions. Let me skip the index 25 everywhere, so because it should be clear that I'm only talking here about the compact and coordinates. Again, so now the left movers and the right movers are related in such a way that we get the same operators here, right? So this is something that has Neumann boundary conditions. So d sigma of x is equal to zero at sigma equal to zero and pi, right? So d sigma, because then there's a sine of n sigma and that's equal to zero at zero and at pi. Now, so what I want to do is to split this into left movers and right movers. And now I'm going to allow a number that I'm going to call x tilde that drops out of this of the sum of left movers and right movers, but which is going to be useful in a moment. again, so X tilde drops out. And let's simply now perform the same operation. So we are going to say, well, it's a slightly duality and see what we get. So we are going to consider the same field, but now we are going to send the right moving modes to minus themselves and x left to x left. So as we just have seen, if we consider a closed bosonic string and we perform this operation, we send, then we get back a closed bosonic string, also compactified in a circle. It has a different radius, but it's still a closed bosonic string. So any guess what we obtain if we do this, if we perform the t-duality? What happens to the open string with no non-boundary fingers? But we can just do the computation and see what we get. So the dual string, the key dual one, is going to be minus xr plus its left half the sigma, right? So I'm going to take the same mod, but now instead of taking the sum, I'm going to take the difference. So x tilde. Anybody see what the boundary conditions for the new coordinate are? So over here we have non-boundary conditions, right? Louder?
There was a relative minus sign, so it's
happening. Let me switch to town city.
Well, yeah, we switched tau and sigma, basically. That's true, yeah. Exactly. Well, okay. We changed a bit more over here. We also changed the oscillators, but that goes in the right direction. Now, so over here, so a moment ago with non-boundary conditions, we had cosine and sigma over here, and we had the tau over there, right? So in this case, the boundary conditions turn out to be like this. So a tau, and so the ends of the string are at zero and at pi, right? So now if sigma is equal to zero, so that vanishes and this is equal to zero. So that's x tilde. And at pi, what we get is x tilde plus I dropped the factor of two somewhere, so a factor of two here. Let me just sneak it in. Plus 2 pi times the momentum. Now, the momentum, again, so is still quantized, so that's going to be k divided by r. And now I can express this. So this is the original circle. So I can express it in terms of the dual circle. So this is going to be 2 pi times k, and in terms of the dual circle, 2 pi r tilde times k. All right, so let's paint a picture. So while a moment ago we had a string with non-boundary conditions, now this is going to be a string with Dirichlet boundary conditions, right? Because now the ends of the string are fixed, right? So sigma equal to 0 is fixed at x tilde, and at the other end is fixed here. So let's paint a picture or something like this. So we have, let's say this one is the dual circle, or filler. So one end of the string is going to be at some point extilla, like this small extilla. Right. And the other point is going to be now k over here, some integer. Right. So this is one end of the string. So that's one end of the string. And the other end is at 2 pi r tilde times k times an integer. So this means that the string is going somehow like this, maybe around several times, depending on the value of k, but it comes back to the same point. Right? So this means that the ends of the string are located at extilla, right? So it's a string with Dirichlet boundary conditions, and they're located at one point in the circle directions. Now, let me actually paint a three-dimensional picture. So imagine that we are, instead of in 26 dimensions, we are just in three. So what this is saying is that there is, let's say this is the extilla dimension over here. So there is one point over here. So the ends of the string are supposed to have a fixed value of extilla, so this point, but they can still be arbitrary in the entire plane. So there's an entire hyperplane where the ends of the string can vary, right? Only the extilla value of the endpoints is going to be fixed, but it can vary in this entire hyperplane. Well, this hyperplane is called the D-brain. So the hyperplane on which the string ends is a D-brain. Now, here's something funny about notation for D-brains. Now, so in this case, we would say that, in the entire discussion, we were talking here about one of the coordinates, the 25th coordinate, right? Now, if we say that the ends of the string are head fixed at the point, let's say, where this coordinate 25 takes some value, that is, let's say, small x 25, right? So it's a point in this dimension. So how many dimensions would the D-brain have in this case? Exactly. So it's fixed. It's a point in one of the dimensions, right? But it's free to move around in all other directions. Now, guess what? This is called a D24 brain, and this is a bit of a silly thing. So, the D-brain is 25 dimensional in this case, and it's called a D24 brain. So because of some reason, people just like to specify the space-like dimensions and not the time-like dimensions. So this would be a D24 brain. All ends of the string have Neumann boundary conditions, then we will talk about what kind of brain. So then the question is, what's the dimension of the hyperplane on which the ends can the ends of the string can live? Right, so in that case, we will talk instead of a D24 about a D25 brain. Right? If all boundary conditions, so it's just a funny thing about D-brain terminology, right? So� if all, let's say, boundary conditions of the auto string are Neumann, right, so that it's allowed to float everywhere around, so then we would talk about a D25 frame. Again, so then the ends of the string can be somewhere in 26 dimensions. All right, now, so this illustrates a general rule that is many times useful. So this goes both ways. We do T-duality, and the Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions simply get exchanged, right? So just think about the process how we derive this. So under T-duality, so general rule. So T-duality exchange, so T-duality exchanges Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions. So this means that after applying T-duality, we do not get back the same theory, but one, let's say, a different. So different boundary conditions. Now, there's a different way of stating this rule in a way that is many times used. So if we have, let's say, a DP brain, so with any number of dimensions, we are going to get a DP minus one brain if T-duality is done in a direction along the brain. And the DP plus one brain is duality is done transverse. That's many times I use the rule, and it's easy. The one just has to think about this a little bit. I mean, if one has this rule, so that should be clear from the computation. So that Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions are going to be exchanged. And this, just a little bit of thought shows that this translates into this rule that's many times useful when dealing with events. Questions? Now, so until this moment, what we have seen is, maybe I can paint it like this. So that's a picture that is often seen. We have seen, we start with normal boundary conditions applied to duality, and we obtain a dual string that has Dirichlet boundary conditions, but where the ends of the string are on the same hyperplane, right? So both ends of the string were fixed at, let's say, the space-time coordinate equal to some point, right? But this is a hyperplane in the 26-dimensional space. So, but both ends are supposed to end on the same plane. Now, so there's a way of modifying the story a little bit in such a way that we can actually not talk only about one D brain, but several D brains. And this is going to be an additional way of getting non-abelian gauge fields in string theory. So we have started with a string, maybe I think it like this, that has an open string, and we have with Neumann boundary conditions, and we have applied T-duality. But now what we can do is, and this idea is inspired from, let's say, from nuclear physics, the idea of a meson, for example. So what we can do is to take the open string, but now attach labels at the ends of the string. Now, so these labels are, and the ones that are usefully chosen, there are different choices, but this is the one we are going to choose over here. We are going to add labels in. And in bar, where this is going to be fundamental representation. a presentation of UN. And this one is going to be the complex conjugate. Representation. Now, so real quick, so UN is going to be in the fundamental representation, it's going to be N times N matrices, which are unitary, U dagger is equal to 1. Right? So now, so this is one representation. So it's the same story as for SON yesterday, right? So yesterday we talked about orthogonal matrices. Now we are going to talk about unitary ones, and we can represent. So we have n times n matrices that satisfy this rule over here, associated to this group, to this Lie group. There's again a Lie algebra, and there are some structure constants, and we can find a realization in terms of n times n matrices, for example, you know, U2, you know, U3, for example, right? So we can do this in terms of n times n matrices, and then it's called the fundamental representation, or there's also the adjoint representation, so that one can also be constructed. Now, the new thing is that for UN, the fundamental representation, so it's going to be like a three-component vector, right? 1, 2, and 3 entries. And on it we have, so if we talk about 3, for example, U3, then we would have a vector with 3 entries, and this would be a 3x3 matrix, for example, right? And the novelty in this case compared to SON is that there is the fundamental representation, so stuff that transforms with the matrix of UN, and there's also the one that transforms with the complex conjugate, so that is going to be the anti-fundamental representation. So there are complex representations in this case that were not present for SON. So in this case, we say that there are some label XI that under a UN transformation transforms like this. And to distinguish it from the complex conjugate, it uses an upstairs index that transforms like this. So then, instead of having one type of open string, there are just going to be different types, right? So they are going to have, depending on what the entries over here or those indices are. So every string state will get an additional factor that is simply the prod lambda ij, that is the product of xi times its j. Now, this is a tensor product, right? So, again, so if this is the fundamental of UN, so I'm just going to take n values, right? The same over here. So this are going to be, it's the tensor product, so I take simply all values of these times all values of these. So there are n square different lambdas. Now, and it turns out that this is exactly the dimension of the adjoint representation, right? So if you say, that is the dimension of the adjoint representation.
Can you explain again what the lambdas are?
What?
What the lambdas
are. Okay. So, we are going to have the string, and we attach these labels over here, xi and xj, to them, right? So these are, for example, like quarks. So then what we are going to do is we are going to say that for every string state phi, so now we have, so if we ignore enum and bar, then we talk about states of the open string, right? Now we are going to attach labels to the end of the open string, and then what we do is to distinguish those. So how many different open strings do we have? Well, this end here can take n values, and this end there can take also n values, right? So the lambda is somehow the coefficient that counts these, right? So it's going to be the product of, let's say, this label here transforming in the fundamental representation times that one. So we are going to promote all the string states to phi. It's going to be lambda I. It's going to go over to lambda ij times phi. Now, so this object should then transform in the tensor product representation. So this is actually the adjoint representation. Representation of U. And now to see the adjoint, so we use the same, to see that this is the adjoint representation, we use the same rule we discussed yesterday for SON. So the number or the dimension of this representation should be the number of independent generators, right? So if we say U dagger is equal to 1, U minus, then we can also say U dagger is equal to U minus 1. So we have, so we are talking here in the fundamental representation, right? So these are n times n matrices that have complex entries, right? So 2n squared, but we have also n times n conditions. So this means that the number of, just doing a very rough counting, that the number, so minus, so these over here are n squared conditions. So this means that the number of independent entries of this matrix, so is equal to n squared, right? Yes?
How do we number the endpoints corresponding
to so we are constructing it that way, right? So we are saying, so imagine, the question we are asking is, now we have an open string and we attach additional degrees of freedom to it. Can we come up? It's like saying, imagine that this open string is a meson, where we have a quark and an antiquark attached to each of the ends of the string. Can we construct a consistent string theory from that? So again, that's one way. There are, of course, consistency rules for this. So the type of gauge groups that are allowed, so we are using this for UN. There are different cases, but this is somehow the simplest one. Now, And the reason sort of why we want to do that is we know that there's, for the open string, there is a massless vector, right? And what we want is objects transforming. If this vector gets promoted to something that transforms in the adjoint representation of UN, that is something that we need in order to construct Young Mid theory. Okay. Now, here's the thing. So we want our theory to be invariant under UN transformations. So so amplitudes. So if we compute any string of amplitudes, any type of amplitudes, they should be invariant. All right, so now what we want to do is to use this idea and apply it to p-duality. So now, so until now, let me back up for a moment. So until now, what we have done is simply to change the open string theory, right? So we had the open string, we had the ends, we are attaching labels, and we are setting up some rules. So this label should be like quark and anti-quark, for example, right? So there is some UN transformation acting on those. Now, it turns out that, so if we now take open strings, and again, compactifying a circle, then it turns out, so a moment ago, so with no, so this object are actually quite concrete on factors. Right, so a moment ago, we argued that the wave function has to be single value, right? So this means that the momentum in the 25 direction has to be quantized, 25 times 2 pi r, right? So from here we concluded that p25 has to be an integer that we call k divided by r. Now it turns out that in the present case, since we know that the theory is invariant under UN transformations, or at least we are setting up the rules so that, so it's not completely arbitrary, we still want to have the theory to be invariant under UN transformations. This means that if we go around the circle, what can still happen is, that, so we are promoting our string space to lambda I and j times phi, where these are the product of fundamental and anti-fundamental representations. So if we go once around the circle like we did over here, what can happen is that the state come back to itself, but only after UN transformation. Like this. Now, so this is a UN transformation acting on the fundamental and the fundamental representation. Now, any UN matrix can be diagonalized. So any UN matrix can be diagonalized. And the eigenvalues are going to have unit norm, so I can write them like this: e to the minus I theta 2, e to the minus I theta n 0, 0. So this means that this argument over here is going to change. In that case, we are going to attach a factor lambda ij to this wave function over here, and then what we are going to allow is a gauge transformation like, or what we are going to do is to allow a UN transformation like this. Right? So in that case, lambda ij r p25 times x25, once we go around the circle, so we are going to pick up an additional factor that is. So this object are going to be diagonal, delta, so e to the minus I, let's say, theta I minus theta j, e to the I, p25 times pi r, So at the end of the day, what these factors are doing, they're shifting the 25 component of the momentum. So the effect of the UN transformation. So I need somehow let's say, 5 additional minutes for this. Time is almost over. So the effect of the UN transformation that we are allowing over here is that the momentum in the 25 direction now is the integer divided by r plus theta j minus theta I divided by 2 pi r. So a different way of saying this is that k, that was a winding number of the dual string, now becomes k plus theta j minus theta I divided by 2 pi. So with this, if we allow this UN transformation, the winding number of the p dual string can become fraction. So let me paint a picture for this. So taking the shift in the momentum into account, and again, we work out the t-dual variable. So then we have different types of strings with indices I and j, so that's going to be x tilde. But the other end is going to be x tilde plus 2 pi r tilde times k. So there's going to be a picture like this, and hopefully the picture will show what's going on here. So let's say we can consider different types of string depending on the value of theta I and theta j. So if we then have the duals here, okay, like this, so that would be the radius r tilde, we can have, let's say we, if we consider strings where theta I is equal to theta j, right? So then we can have strings that have k is equal to 0. So in that case, if k is 0, the starting point and the end point of the string are going to be at the same point. So let's say this is going to be x tilde. So that would be somehow a string that has k is equal to 0 and theta I is equal to theta j. Now, how do I paint the string where k, let's say I still want these to be equal, but I want k is equal to 1. So these are still equal, but I want k is equal to 1. How do I paint it? Right, so that one would go around like this, right? No. So the novelty are this, is the case, let's say, for example, theta 1 is not equal to theta 2, because then one would have, so this over here looks like fractional winding. So these were the eigenvalues of this unitary matrix, they can be arbitrary, right? So this can be fractional numbers. And we can have a picture like this, let's say 1 and is of x tilde, right? And then the other end would be located at a different point, right, in the compact dimension. So this would be the case, theta 1 is not equal to theta 2. Now maybe, so one doesn't see these pictures very much, so those are not nice. The picture one usually sees is something like this. So in this case, we would be talking about 1D, so if we talk about the massless field, so let's keep k is equal to 0. So a string that starts and ends on the same D brain would look like this. Now, in this case, the ends of the string are at different points, right? So this means there are two hyperplanes on which the string can end. So in this case, we actually would have 2D brains. And then the picture would be like this. So here we have the end of the of one end of the string like that, and the other end would be like this, right? So they would end on different... on different hyperplanes. Or if you want, I mean, depends which is your favorite picture, so in the three-dimensional picture, so one hyperplane would be located at this point on the entire plane, and the other point would be this one, right? So, and depending on how many thetas we have, we can have that many brands. So this construction is then useful to consider to have several brands like this on which the strings can end. Now, with that proof, let me simply plot how the mass formula has changed. Now the mass formula now for the strings that have endpoints, let's say this is the hyperplane corresponding to theta 1, this one the hyperplane corresponding to theta 2. So there is a mass formula that is now going to be changed by the values of theta I and theta j, like this. So let's say again we consider the case, we want to stick to k's equal to 0. Imagine that we are interested in understanding the mass spectrum, so let's use a winding that is equal to 0. Right, so then we have for, let's say, theta 1 is not equal to theta 2, we are going to have 2 d brains, right? So this is equal to 0, and we're going to have 2 d brains. Then we are going to have 2 types of massless vectors, namely those that correspond to when I and j is both equal to 1, so then we would have theta 1 minus theta 1. Let's say I paint the vector like this. So it's still going to be a massless vector because we are still quantizing the open string, right? So it's free to move around in all dimensions. It's still an open string with non-boundary conditions, but now it's constrained to live on the D-brain, right? So we would have one gauge field that ends, whose ends are fixed on one D-brain. And then we would have another gauge field like this. So this one would be a U1 times U1 gauge theory, if you want. Right, so where one U1 gauge field lives here, so this time would be equal to 0. We would have a massless U1 gauge field here and a massless U1 gauge field there. But now consider the case in which also this term over here, theta I minus theta j goes to 0, so strings, for example, like this, would be mass, right, because of this term theta 1 minus theta 2. But for in the case that theta 1 for theta 1 approaching theta 2, there are additional massless states, or additional massless vectors. And one can actually show, but this is somehow the intuitive picture, that U1 times U1 then gets enhanced to U2, and one can repeat the same process and then show if one has n points, then one would get a U1 escape symmetry. Now, some of you, this discussion was a little bit past this last one with the champagne and factors. Okay, I mean, it's so hopefully, I mean, it should be. So, all right. Questions? Yes?
In your picture that you've drawn 3 strings, I assume the one that's connected to 2D brains is the actual string, and the ones with the gauge degrees of freedom? Is that correct?
So this string over here, it's like. Okay, so we would have the D-brains, we would have the string, and this is massive, so if they are apart. But then, so if that comes close together, additional massive state, that would also be going to engage these, and then we get this enhancement. I mean, we would have to compute really the spectrum, and we didn't do it, so this is really sketchy. But so one sees, sort of, if one has the string stretching between the brains, and the brains come close to each other, then the additional massive state is sort of what the formula is saying. And then this actually one can show if one now carefully computes the entire spectrum of which gauge fields live on which brain, which ones live in space, and one can actually show that there is an enhancement from the T1 and T1 to on the D brain, instead of having just one gauge field here, one gauge field there, so they combine to do something in that domain. I haven't really shown it, so it's more questions.